Welcome to the Execution Zone podcast, where we tackle the challenge of why executing strategy is so much harder than actually creating it. We talk openly and honestly with entrepreneurs and leaders who will share the behind-the-scenes story of their own journey. This will give you the insights that you need to shortcut your own path to success. Welcome to this week's episode of the Execution Zone podcast. I'm Abby White. This week we have on the absolutely phenomenal Kemi Nekvapil. And Kemi is a speaker, she's a coach, she is a facilitator, and someone who personally has already impacted my life in so many ways. That sounds cheesy, but I share the story as we go through the podcast. I am so grateful that Kemi spent the time with us on the podcast because I believe that her approach is exactly what we need to hear right now. And her guidance that she offers through this podcast is really, really valuable to all of us during this sort of challenging coronavirus time. So during this week's episode, we're going to talk about what as leaders we can be doing right now, how Kemi is personally navigating the coronavirus situation, some of her guidance to us during this time. We talk about the gift of asking. Kemi wrote a book on this topic, and this is what sort of personally changed things for me. So Kemi guides us through that conversation. And then we talk about some of the barriers that we might have to execution. You know, things aren't always smooth sailing. We do get setbacks and how we can navigate our way through that. Kemi said a quote, which I loved on her website, around inspired has you sitting in the chair looking at someone else. Empowered has you sitting in yourself saying yes. We dig into that quote and what it means to be empowered. We then go through some of Kemi's own high performance habits and some of the habits and rituals that she has in her life that are really valuable to her. And then we finish on a quick fire round with her person she would like to interview the most as a guest, and also her favorite books that have had the biggest impact on her. This is a really, really, really valuable podcast. So grab a pad, a pen, and a coffee and get ready to make some notes and enjoy. Welcome to this week's podcast episode where we have the absolutely phenomenal Kemi Nekvapil. Kemi is an ICF credentialed executive and personal coach. Kemi is also a speaker and facilitator who's worked in the wellness industry for more than 25 years. Having studied leadership and purpose at the Gross National Happiness Center in Bhutan, trained as a yoga teacher in India with a 23-year yoga and meditation practice, Kemi understands that there's a process for meaningful connection to ourselves, our work, our families, and communities. In her coaching practice, Kemi works with female leaders to unlock the obstacles that prevent value-based leadership. And as a facilitator, Kemi designs programs and speaks for global organizations. In 2018, she was invited to Richard Branson's Necker Island and was asked to sit on a panel discussing humanity at work. And she's recently returned from Texas training with the amazing Brené Brown as a Dare to Lead facilitator. Kemi now works with teams and organizations to create daring leaders and courageous cultures. She is also the author of Raw Beauty, The 7 Principles to Nourish Your Body, Transform Your Mind, and Create the Life You Want. And another book, The Gift of Asking, A Woman's Guide to Creating Personal Power. Not only that, Kemi is also a mother of teenagers, a wife, and an endurance athlete running 42K to 100K races. Wow. And a dedicated gardener and lover of really good food. Welcome to the podcast, Kemi.
Thank you. Well, it's important, I think, in bios, if we can share a little bit of who we are as well as what we do, then we get to present as whole humans, which is important.
Absolutely. Hey, I'm taking my hat off for the fact you're a mum of teenagers. That part got me. Sod Brené Brown.
Well, it's interesting. I have to say, having teenagers in lockdown, I'm really thankful for. My heart goes out to all of those parents that have, like yourself, actually, Abby, that have, you know, young ones that are still sort of knee high that require so much attention. Whereas at the moment, teenagers just don't want to have a bar of me or my husband. So everyone can just get on with what they need to do in lockdown. So I'm very grateful to have teenagers at this current time in history.
Yeah, the fact that you're not cool and they don't need you is actually great right now.
I'm so happy to not be cool right now. So happy.
I'm definitely struggling with the 18-month-old that's glued to my ankles. And yeah. Yes. So look, I want to start. I've got so many questions that I want to go through with you and super excited to have you on. But I want to start a little bit just sort of more, although we've shared your bio, filling in the gaps around how you came to be doing what you're doing. Because having seen you speak multiple times now, whenever you speak, it's like, oh, wow, she totally has found her true calling, as cheesy as that sounds. And it's like, yeah, you were totally born to be doing this. I think at Nine to Thrive with Business Chicks, when I saw you speak and there was like, I don't know, a couple thousand people in the room, and every single person's like bawling, crying. It's like, oh yeah, she's got this. So can you fill in the gaps around how you came to be sort of a coach, a speaker, a facilitator, and sort of found your true calling without sounding too cheesy?
I do have to say for those listening that people don't always cry when I speak. That isn't my intention. But that was an incredible group of people, an incredible experience at Nine to Thrive with Business Chicks. You know, it's interesting, I think, that for many of us that get to do the work that we love, when we look back, we realize that we started doing it long before we got paid. I actually started facilitating groups of people when I was 14 years old, and it was at a local community center, and I was asked to direct the up-and-coming play. So that was the first time that I was in a position where I held space for others and tried to pull out the strengths of others while at the same time navigating the energies and strengths and weaknesses of those that I was surrounded by. So that's when it first started. So that was, I was 14, I'm now 45. So it's been quite a lot of years, decades, that I have been holding space for other people. I started coaching, well, what I called coaching probably about 8 years ago. So I had a business that was based around raw food, and I would run workshops from my home. It started very small, very humbly. And I realized that many, many women at that time, and probably still now, a lot of the focus was on, you know, how big they were, what their dress size was going to be. And the relationship they had with food was never around fueling their body to do what they wanted to do. It was always around fueling their body so that they could wear a particular dress or look a certain way. And it was from there that I started running retreats, because I realized that I wanted to spend time with women having bigger conversations than our waist sizes. And I started running retreats in Bali and here in Victoria, in Melbourne, and started coaching. And to be honest, what I would probably say is that at the time, what I was probably doing was doing a little bit of consulting and a little bit of advice giving, which actually isn't the role of a coach. I then trained to become a credentialed coach, and I've been doing that now for 7 years. And I love it. And it is an absolute privilege and an honor to create a safe space for people to show up. I love the women that I work with. I do predominantly work with women. I work with women that are leaders in different ways, you know, in different areas of their life. Kind of my criteria for the women that I work with is that they need to be willing to get into the mucky stuff so they can then do the work that they want to do in the world. So that's what led me from facilitating to coaching, and leads me to where I am now. And part of that has also now included writing as well, becoming an author. I love to share through words, whether it's on the page or whether it's directly like I am now.
Yeah. I'm curious about the speaking part as well, because having seen you speak quite a few times, you know, you're a phenomenal speaker. I don't know whether it's also the British thing as well that I connect with your humor, because you can talk about something like you share about your personal story and, you know, some of that, which is sort of obviously a difficult conversation, and then you just break out a joke into the humor side as well. So I think your speaking style, like, is something I really connect with. How did you also move into the speaking part of your career?
It's a good question. I think probably for most speakers, you're asked to speak about something. I think one thing that I do have that I never knew was going to stand me in such good stead is that I did train as an actor, and I was an actor in England. And what that means for me as a speaker, I suppose, in the way that I speak and the way that I facilitate from stage, and maybe what's different from other speakers, is I'm really comfortable on stage, and I am comfortable to work with the energies of the people in front of me. So I go in with an idea. I work with my client around what it is that they want from me speaking, or they're wanting their audience to gain from me being there. But also, if I'm getting a particular energy from the people in front of me, I can very quickly pivot and give what I feel is what is needed in front of me. And sometimes I can tell when the audience is ready to go a little bit deeper. I can tell when we need a little bit of levity. I can tell when we need a break, when we need to stand up, when we need to stretch. So for me, it's very much about working with the energy in front of me, which is to do as well with the fact that I have, you know, I do have a spiritual yoga practice that I've had for 25 years now, and a meditation practice. So I'm happy to be with what is ever in front of me. I can be with people's, you know, sometimes when I'm facilitating, and especially doing the Day to Lead program, which I know we'll move on to, and some of the work that I do around women and worth and women and leaders, is that it can be emotional because people are uncovering internal obstacles about why they are where they are or how they achieve what they achieved. And to be able to be with that allows for us to do some really transformational work, and that's the work that I'm interested in. I'm not interested in being a speaker that stands on the stage and inspires people. I'm not interested in being a speaker that stands on a stage and tells people what they should be doing. I want to create a space where people work out for themselves what they want to do next.
Yeah, and I've got so many questions to get into on this, because this is what I love about your approach. I mean, obviously, the business here is the Execution Zone, and it is all about executing, and that's what I love. You're not the hype inspirational speaker. You are inspirational by very default, but you translate it into action, and I'll share a little bit later how that's actually played out for me. I'd love to change tact a little bit and talk about Brené Brown first, or Dr. Brené Brown. Yeah, welcome, Kemi. We're going to talk about Brené. I have to get the girl crush bit out of the way first. What was it like meeting Brené Brown?
I'll share a little story because I think it will give you a bit more of an idea. So I arrived in Texas, in San Antonio, Texas, and there were 120 of us from around the world that had been chosen to come and do the Dare to Lead training, which means that we can facilitate the Dare to Lead program, the 16-hour program, which is about to be bumped up to a 24-hour program to do with individuals and with organizations. And I walked into that room. And, you know, Brené entered and she's like, "Hi all, how you all going?" and everything. And it was fantastic. And one of the things that she asked us to do within the Dare to Lead book, if you've read the book, she talks about permission slips. And quite a few facilitators use this in different ways, where you literally have a post-it note and you write on it, you write giving yourself permission to do something or to not do something. And I was in that room and everyone was sort of, you know, waiting for Brené to arrive, and Brené arrives. And I realized that I was being not quite as excited as I wanted to be, that I felt that to be, and this is an English thing as well, Abby, you'll get this, you know, kind of like, don't be too anything, just keep it on the down low. Do not draw any attention to yourself. Do not be too excited. And I remember thinking, if I was to write a permission slip to myself right now, it would be to be as excited as I am. That to have followed Brené's work for a very long time, to then be in a room with her, being chosen by her and her faculty to then share her work, how exciting that was and what a gift that was. So I'd sort of given myself this internal permission of, you are allowed to be as excited. You do not have to be cool. You do not have to be that you have it all together. You can be excited. And then somebody on my table said to me, have you picked up your Dare to Lead hoodie? And I said, what? And, you know, I'm a runner, so I wear a lot of hoodies post-running and pre-running. I was like, there's a hoodie? There's a hoodie as well as Brené Brown? And I literally then, like a child, just kind of screamed off, skipping to where the room where the hoodies were. So, look, that was my first moment where, you know, Brené does give us permission to have all the feelings. Excitement, joy, all of those things. Being in the room with her was incredible. I would want to say it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but I actually know that it's not going to be, because as a Dare to Lead facilitator, there will be retreats where we will spend time with Brené, feeding back to her how the work is on the ground, how it's working with organisations, what's working, what's not working. She's been very generous in saying, you know, I have 20 years of research, but I need to know how this work is working with people, with organisations. It's great to be part of the alumni of the work. It is great to be able to share the work and to experience and witness the difference that the Dare to Lead program makes to individual leaders and also teams and organisations as a whole.
Yeah, I love that. So do you now sport your Dare to Lead hoodie around the house or before you go for a run, and it's like your favourite?
Yeah, basically my uniform. It's interesting, actually. One has to be mindful of how many hoodies one has. And I only allow myself a certain number. And a couple had to go when the Dare to hoodie got brought home. It was like, I'm sorry, chaps, this is it. You're out.
So. Tough times. That's brutal. So on the topic of leadership and dare to lead, the C bomb, the C word, we have to talk about it. You know, for leaders right now during coronavirus, we are being asked to step up. We are being asked to lead. There's a lot being asked of us. So coming up from sort of your skill set around leadership, what right now is sort of your guidance, I guess, that you would give to leaders to support and lead their teams during these sort of quite challenging times?
I think there are two things that come to mind. One that I believe is critical for leadership in the 21st century anyway, and one that I think everyone needs to be more aware of than usual. So the first one that I would say, and Brené has a great quote on this, so I'll share the quote and then I'll expand on that. So the quote is, leaders who are not willing to attend to the feelings and emotions of their team are going to spend a disproportionate amount of time dealing with dysfunctional behaviors and problems. And at this time right now, we are all feeling a lot, and it is really important for leaders to be willing to be with the feelings and emotions of their teams. It doesn't mean it's their job to fix it. It doesn't mean it's their job to make it better. I think what most of us want is just to know that someone has heard us and that our feelings are validated. I actually was speaking to a client the other day who runs a team. She's the CEO of an organization. And, you know, she was asking, how much time do I spend on this stuff? You know, that, and a lot of my team are going really well, but there's a couple that need a lot of extra attention. And I said, well, it's interesting because how much time do we need to be heard? We don't know. I said, but I can guarantee that if you're willing to give the 40 minutes today, you probably don't need to give 40 minutes tomorrow. But if you give 5 minutes today, you're going to need to give a lot of 5 minutes. So that would be my first guidance, that as uncomfortable as it may be, because it depends how comfortable we are with our own feelings. That has a huge impact if we can be with the feelings of others. But definitely be willing to be with your team right now. And feelings are changing for all of us every single day, sometimes hour to hour, minute to minute, moment to moment. So to be with that, because then your team will be able to step up when you need them to. If you can step up for them to be a human, you know, that the work I'm doing around being 100% human at work and with that organization is, if you are willing to be human with your team right now, they will step up for you. They will be loyal for you. And part of that is being vulnerable and sharing how you're going, sharing how you're going, because that's what creates a safe space for somebody else to say, and this is how I'm going. So that would be my first piece of guidance out there. And the second is for leaders right now, for all of us, but really for leaders as well, is radical self-care, radical self-care. To put more boundaries in place so that you can lead the way that you need to rest more, to take time out more for yourself, to boundary up so that you can be of service, not so that you're putting up walls, but so that when you're giving, you can give what it is that you need to give for yourself and for your teams. And for those of, you know, those of us that are working from home, whether we're used to it or not used to it, having very defined lines between when you're at home and when you're working, and that's different for each person. There are so many people out there right now that are saying, if you do A, B, C, and D, it'll give you this result. I don't believe in that as a coach. I believe that it's worth us as leaders taking time out ourselves and working out, what is it I need to do to transition from work, which may just be the spare room, to the kitchen? You know, is it that I go for a walk around the block first? Is it that I do my workout at the end of the day? Is it that I put on my favorite track and have a dance? Is it that I, you know, watch a little bit of a TV show at the end of my working day so I can transition? But take the time to work out, what do you need to do so you're not pulled between the two spaces? Because all of us know that never works.
Yeah, and that's so interesting on both of those points. The be human one I found interesting in that some, you know, I come from a corporate background, and some of the corporates that you're used to seeing be quite formal, suddenly, you know, it's completely socially acceptable that, so I'll take my husband is in IT, and at the moment our 18-month-old son thinks it's amazing when he's on Zoom to run in and be like, hi. And my husband's company have been brilliant about going, look, we're just going to embrace it. When a kid completely gate crashes a meeting, we're just going to embrace it. And that level of being more human, yes, in terms of, I do have kids, I do have all these other things, you know, is actually quite refreshing.
It is refreshing. And actually, I've been on quite, well, who hasn't been on quite a few Zoom meetings recently? Thriving. I'm so excited for all the organisations that are thriving right now through this. Where, you know, the leaders or the people that are chairing the meeting will say, and, you know, who are you, who's in the house with you right now? Let's just get a rundown. Who's in the house? Who might be coming in? What do we need to watch out for? So everyone can just say, okay, I'm here, I'm on my own, but I've got a dog, Charlie, who likes to jump up on my lap. And then someone else will say, I've got a 7-year-old and a 6-year-old. The 7-year-old is fine. The 6-year-old is watching Frozen for the 17th time today. And, you know, they may come in for me to press the iPad button. And so everyone's like, oh, okay, so we are human and we can still do a good job at work. And actually, is the ability for me to state that I'm human, that I have a life outside of my work, actually allowing me to do my work better?
Now that's a good question. And I think this is where everyone talks about afterwards, we're going back to normal. I actually think some things are going to change for the better out of this, because it will be probably for many companies more acceptable to work from home and to have Charlie run in and so on. So there's actually some, I feel like my mother every time I say it, but some silver linings that are coming out of this.
I think it would be a shame if, I think we would have missed a global opportunity if we go back to normal, in inverted commas. Mm. This is the time for artists. I heard someone say the other day, this is the time for artists, and that artists can give us gateways into ways of being. And there is some beautiful poetry that is making its way around now. And one of them is, before we rush back to normal, we should take the time to consider what part of normal is worth rushing back to. And, you know, we have this time to look at, you know, I think most of us are missing hugs. So rushing back to hugs is a good thing. Rushing back to a life where maybe we feel we're not in charge of it and we're being kind of driven may not be worth going back to. Rushing back to fast fashion, rushing back to, you know, big organizations where maybe you could support the local grocer and the local butcher and your local theatres. You know, there's opportunities. There's some incredible opportunities. And once again, only each of us as individuals can decide what is important for me coming out of this and where do I want to put my attention and my energy and my money.
Yeah, I love that. And so whilst we're sort of on the C-bomb of coronavirus, how are you personally navigating it? Because obviously, you know, I look at some of your work that I'm aware of where, you know, you are a speaker. So, you know, a lot of those I imagine would have been postponed. I know you were about to do an amazing trip with the Hunger Project, which obviously has been postponed. So it has obviously impacted your world just as much as anybody else's. So what are you sort of, I guess, leaning into at the moment and finding is working for you at this time?
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, I have my coaching practice where I do work from home anyway. That hasn't changed, and I'm incredibly grateful for that. But yes, you're right. My speaking engagements have all been postponed or they've been cancelled. And I had a big year of travel this year, and it may not be politically correct, but I miss travel. I was going to be going to many continents this year, and all of that's been postponed or put on hold, and I understand that, and that's fine. I'm really happy that the emissions are going down, and it'll be interesting to see how travel comes back and what that looks like. How am I navigating it? Day by day, crumpet by crumpet, I think I would have to say. For those listeners that don't know what a crumpet is.
Such a British answer. I'm killing myself.
you know, I think all of us who's are, you know, in times like this, we all have to work out what are our comfort foods. So a crumpet is, actually, I think maybe they're Scottish. But anyway, I think most people understand what a crumpet is. But, you know, basically it's wheat. It's wheat. Add in some form of fat, form of butter or margarine or something, and add some jam on top. So crumpet by crumpet. But one day at a time. I'm very grateful for my spiritual practices at this time. I've doubled down on them, my meditation, my yoga. I don't have any judgment on how I feel from moment to moment. I feel very blessed to have quite a kind inner voice, actually. I allow myself all the feelings and I don't judge them. I get curious about them. And if I wake up and I'm just like, nah, we can now. You know, if you wake up and you're just feeling a bit like, nah, I'm not going to, I look at what are the priorities for this day and then I call it a day. And that may be then going into the garden or going for a very, very long walk or, you know, doing some FaceTime with close friends or playing Scrabble with my daughter or listening to the music that my son is making. Or, yeah, that's how I'm navigating it day by day, knowing that there will be an endpoint But right now, this is being given to us. And for those of us that aren't sick, for those of us that aren't on the front line, that there are some hidden opportunities, and it may just be to sleep. You know, a lot of people don't get enough sleep. It may just be that you're getting to sleep more. So that's how I'm navigating it day by day, with no judgment, no criticism, taking what I need. Sometimes that's crumpets. Sometimes it's a long run. Sometimes it's ice cream. And it all works.
Yeah, I love that. And it's interesting. We had in February Jacinta McDonald from Anytime Fitness, or previously Anytime Fitness. Yeah. I love her. She came and spoke at one of our events in February, and she talked about on the Anytime Fitness journey, when things got really difficult and really tough, she, her go-to would be exactly what you said, which is to double down on her self-care. Mm. And that's really stuck with me throughout this process. Now, self-care is pretty interesting. This morning I tried to do exercise with my toddler and accidentally kicked him in the head. So no judgment. You said no judgment.
No, there's no judgment. There's no judgment. Obviously he's fine because you're not at the hospital right now. So it obviously ended up well.
He's fine. He survived. But like, that's what I'm sort of having to take from it, is double down on the self-care, but in just pockets of, it might be 10 minutes before he loses it. Or it might be, you know, I'm actually, interestingly, shout out for Kemi's podcast. I used to do a lot of podcasts on the way commuting to work and had quite long commutes. And now that I'm not doing that, I've actually found all new podcasts. So like the Shift series, that are actually quite short, sharp, and actually give you that sort of small nugget. So I guess I'm learning, for me, sort of in terms of what you're saying, is it, self-care doesn't have to mean I have 3 hours. It can mean I've got 15 minutes to listen to your podcast, or I've got 10 minutes to do a workout before I kick Jaden in the head by accident, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's what it is. And I think we're going to cause ourselves a lot of suffering if we try and replicate life before we were in lockdown. We're setting ourselves up for a lot of disappointment, you know, for ourselves, disappointing ourselves, but also if we're expecting the same from others, then there's going to be a lot of suffering and a lot of disappointment. If we can all be a little bit easier on each other and lower our expectations, it's going to serve people better. Yeah. Mm.
So I want to use that as a bit of a segue into talking about The Gift of Asking. So you wrote a book called The Gift of Asking, and I'll share super briefly, like, this topic for me has been game changing. So Kemi presented, I actually had to look it up, and it was nearly a year ago. It was May last year. At Nice Thrive, the Business Chicks event we were referring to, and I sort of won't give too much away about the process because I want Kemi to talk about it in her words, but Kemi talks about, you know, who would you ask for help, what help would you ask for right now, and Kemi, you know, made us play the game, made us get out our notepad and actually make a note of it, and so reluctantly I sort of did it. And interestingly, I found myself getting really emotional. And at the time, my son was only sort of a really small bubs, had a chronic cough, was up coughing, you know, all hours of the night, vomiting every single night. And we were sort of averaging 2 to 3 hours of sleep for about 7 months on end. Plus, I had a really, really high growth business and so on. Punchline, when I did the process of The Gift of Asking that Kemi's going to talk to us about, my thing was I would ask my mum for help. And I find it, I don't talk about it a lot because I find it quite difficult, but it was that, you know, you're pretending the baby's fine, the business is fine, and you're going, you know, it's all fine. And I didn't ask for help, and asking my mom to come from the UK, which is thousands of dollars, and my parents lead a very active life. So PS, can you spend a few thousand dollars, come over here and just sort of help us? And punchline, I did it. And I asked my mom for help. And a couple weeks later, my parents got on a plane and they came and they stayed for about 6 weeks. And helped us through that period when, you know, things just were, the wheels were falling off. So I look at it as that, getting emotional, that time and that conversation with Kemi that you went through with us at Nine to Thrive actually genuinely changed my life, and it changed us and got us the help that we needed. And it's changed my outlook in terms of stopping asking for help and not being fearful of my mother saying, I told you so. but actually, very British thing. But getting that help. So I sort of, with that long explanation, sort of want you to talk to us about The Gift of Asking and actually some guidance around how we go about this.
Well, first of all, I think everyone has a fear of their mother saying, I told you so. I love that story that you shared, Abby. And, you know, I came across this idea of asking because I'd be working with my clients, and it didn't really matter where they sort of were within their careers, whether they were, you know, really thriving in a business, or whether they're on a hiatus. when it came to asking, whether it was asking for a financial injection, whether it was asking a team member for something or asking for clarity around something, that was where there was a block, like an internal block. And so I started asking when I was speaking, you know, why don't we ask for things? And just by asking people, I started gaining all of this kind of evidence around, we don't ask because we think we're going to be a burden. We don't ask because we want to look like we have it all together. We don't ask because we should know. We don't ask because they may say no, we may be rejected. And the more I asked, the more I realized that actually we were making a real rod for our backs. That if we don't, you know, we are societal human beings. We want to be together. We thrive together. This idea that we all sort of, and I think, you know, this is coming more to the fore now that we're in lockdown and we're experiencing what we're experiencing, how connected we are. I heard a few weeks ago, never before can we deny how connected we are as a global community, because we all have one immune system and we all have to stay in our home to protect the immune system of the whole world. And so we need each other. We need each other, and yet we have created this society where success is I can do it on my own. And the reality is that most of us will support other people if we can, if we have the mental, material resources to do so. And what I would ask when I was talking is, you know, who likes to support and help others? And everyone in their hand, you know, everyone in the room would put their hand up. And then I would ask, and who likes asking for help? And hardly anyone would put their hand up. And so there was this massive gap between what we want to offer each other, but what we're willing to ask for. And so part of the book, there are many different asking processes in the book, but the one that you're speaking about, Abby, is where I ask people to think about, you know, where is an area in your life where you are feeling frustrated, overwhelmed, angry, resentful, tired, and then to ask, who is the person that could support you in that area? And I make a kind of joke about it, because I always say, and it's the person you just thought of. And as Abby would have said, you know, I don't want it to be my mum, you know, I don't want it to so, but it's normally the first person we think of, and we have a reason why we're not asking. So that's my next question. Why are you not asking? You know, why are you not asking for more responsibility in the project? Why are you not asking for more support in that area? Why are you not asking for childcare? Whatever it may be. And this process allows people to decide, am I going to ask? When am I going to ask by? But the work, I think the most important work is the pre-work, not so much just the action. For me, it's always about meaningful action. So we have to work out, why am I not asking? What is my barrier? And spend time in that area before committing to, okay, this is the cost of me not asking. This is why I'm not asking. Okay, I'm going to ask. And it is, it's a very, very simple but a very powerful process. And the reality is that, you know, in the book is a chapter called How to Say No, because a lot of women will be asked and will say yes at the detriment of themselves, and they don't have the capacity to say yes. So there is a chapter in the book as well that also looks at ways to say no, because I know that that's as important as saying yes sometimes.
And I think the interesting thing around the asking process is, a lot of the time we're expecting a no and it's a yes. And actually, I look at some of it. I even said to you, like, when I asked you to come on the podcast and you were like, yeah, sure. I was like, well, she just said yes. and I think some of the time it is just literally sometimes going through the process you talk to, but also having the courage to ask the question. And a lot of the time we might get that unexpected yes, whether that's the pay rise, whether it's you on the podcast, whether it's, you know, whatever, can I have more responsibility on the project? And actually we're often surprised. Have you found that's the case?
Oh, look, it's so interesting, because one thing I think we forget when we're asking someone as well, we're also empowering them to bring their gifts to the table. You know, so we can think, let's talk about Barbara. Okay. So Barbara works within the team, and we know that Barbara is great at getting projects together efficiently with really, really clear research to back up the project. She just does it in a way that looks beautiful, that's designed beautifully. And we know though that Barbara is also overwhelmed with her own project. So we think, we won't ask Barbara. She's already overwhelmed. She won't want to do it. Now, in coaching, what we call that is that's doing somebody else's thinking for them. The only way we know if Barbara is going to take on the project is if we ask her. Now, if we ask Barbara and Barbara says, actually, I do have other projects, but one of them finished yesterday and the next one is going to finish in 4 days. If you're happy for me to bring this back to you in 7 days, I would love to do it. To be honest, I was hoping you would ask me. in that moment, it's a win-win. Barbara understands that her gifts are really valued. Barbara gets to choose what she wants to do. We don't choose for her, and we get the help and the support that we need. And then we know it's going to be a great project because everyone is invested in that project. But what we tend to do, and it's also a little bit of a shield, a protective shield, is that we do other people's thinking for them. We say, oh, no, she won't want to, he won't want to, I'll just do it for myself. And that's where we end up overwhelmed, upset, resentful, frustrated they didn't offer. You know, one of the chapters in the book is called The Mind Readers, and you'll know that chapter, Abby, because it just says the mind readers, and there's only one line in that chapter which says there are none, because we expect people to know what we want, and the reality is that people do not know what we want. We need to ask them.
I love that. And so much of your, this sort of brings me to another point I wanted to talk to you about, because so much of your work and what I love about it, and we sort of touched on it a little bit before, it's not about necessarily inspiration, it's about empowering people. Mm-hmm. And I found this quote that I've got to read, that I think I found it on from your showreel from one of your talks, where you said, inspired has you sitting in the chair looking at someone else. Empowered has you sitting in yourself saying yes. Now, we're obviously the execution zone, all about taking action. And so what I love that is that shift to empowered. How do you guide people through that process from inspired to empowered and help them through that journey?
It's an interesting thing. You know, there are different ways of doing it as a speaker where you're speaking to a lot of people at one time, and when I'm speaking to an individual client. So I don't believe in action for action's sake. I think time is so precious for all of us. I think the really important work is to take the time to figure out who we are, figure out what is important to us, and what are the things that we want to spend our time and energy on. Once we're clear on those things, then we start looking at, am I committed to taking action? And then what does the action look like? So there's lots of questions in coaching. It depends on who I'm speaking to, depending on the question that comes. You know, I don't have a pre-scripted list of questions to ask a client. But one of the questions that I can just share for myself. So one of the questions that I ask myself is, if I didn't do this and I was on my deathbed, how would I feel? And I am not someone that commits to a lot of things, but what I'm committed to, I'm 100% committed to. And so that's a really defining question for me. Like if I get to my deathbed and I'm like, oh, it would have been nice to have learned Italian, but doesn't matter. And actually Italian was something I wanted to learn when I lived in England. And I have decided many years ago now, actually that would have been nice, but it's not going to happen. Let it go. So what I do when I'm speaking to an audience is the same. I give them permission to look at, okay, so what are the things that would be nice to have? And what are the things that you're willing to get uncomfortable to have? And when I mean uncomfortable, I don't necessarily mean physically uncomfortable unless it's a physical feat that they're wanting to do. But it's, you know, are you willing to stretch yourself? Are you willing to grow? Are you willing to not know? Are you willing to not be very good to begin with? Are you willing to ask for help and support to get to where it is that you want to go? So for me, taking the time to get very clear on why the action is in, or why the goal is important, is more important than the action themselves. So the actions themselves will actually take care of themselves if we are committed. If we are committed, and also if we take the time to look at how we might get unstuck, that's also important.
So talk to us about that, because I think that's interesting, because when we start to, a lot of the time, the barriers to execution aren't necessarily for want of good ideas. You know, we've all got great ideas. Italian is a great language. But often it is about then getting stuck, like you said, around, okay, how am I going to stretch myself? How am I going to get out of my comfort zone? You know, how am I going to actually go into action? And so how do you help people through that part of the process? They might have got the commitment piece, but then still have the wobbles as you're starting to actually do the doing. And like I said, that's where, you know, we talk ourselves out of it. You know, we procrastinate and go through all those different phases. How do you help people through that phase of the process into the doing?
Well, this is the thing, like I said, it's different from when I'm working with an individual client who I may have been working with for, you know, for a very long time, for, you know, months or even years, to if I'm, you know, standing in front of a group of people that I've never met before because they're an audience. So if I'm working with a client, I know them. We get to know each other very well. And part of my job as a coach is to be an accountability partner. Now, that doesn't mean I'm texting them every day, have you done it, have you done it, have you done it, because they're fully grown adults. But they know that in sharing it with me that there is somebody else that is holding that vision for them. And one of the questions that I will ask a client is, what will trip you up? You know, so we've got the what will trip you up? And this is where self-awareness is really important, because then the person will say, oh, I know that if, you know, I know that if my friend calls me and asks me to go to that thing, that I'm going to want to go because I always do, and that means I won't do my practice, you know. Or I know that if Janine in finance says to me, we don't have the budget for that, then I feel, what's the point? I won't think to ask anybody else. So I'll get them to list what are the things that are going to take you out of the game that you've created, the game that you want to play. If I'm speaking to an audience, I will ask the same thing. I'll say, what would be the top three things that would have this not happen? You know, and it gets people being very honest with themselves. I'll get really bored because I get bored all the time. I will probably want to go to the pub instead of staying home and doing whatever it is I'm supposed to be doing. You know, whatever it is. And then we look at, okay, so if that's what you know are the things that could take you out of the game, what do you need to put in place? What support systems do you need? What is it that you need to make sure that when or if that happens, you've already got a backup plan? Because it's delusional to think that we are going to create a goal, commit to it, and it's going to be smooth sailing to the end. Delusional. It is not going to be smooth sailing. You are going to want to back out sometimes. It is going to hurt sometimes, physically, emotionally, ego. You know, your ego may be hurt. But if you're committed, it means I am in for the long haul and I'm willing to get to the mucky bits and I'm willing to be scared and I'm willing to not know. And I'm willing to grow through that so I can get to the goal that I have chosen as important.
I love that. That's so good. And it's really interesting because we know that whatever goal we set, you are going to have a load of hurdles. Yeah. So doing that pre-work of how you're going to navigate it is brilliant.
Yeah. And also there'll be other things that you never considered, you know, that will come, and they may be the making of the goal. You know, I think one of the most beautiful things, and as I said, I'm not a coach that's focused on action for action's sake. I'm focused on progress. I've had clients who have come to me with a particular goal and then halfway through the goal have realized, oh my gosh, it's not even my goal. It's my mum's goal or my dad's goal, or a goal that I had 20 years ago that I kind of feel like if I don't do it, I'm a failure. And so even that, to me, that is progress. Progress would not be continuing with that goal, pretending it was your goal when you've realized it's actually not mine. I'm not interested in this. It's taking too much. I don't want to do this. So sometimes the pursuit of the goal is the beginning of the journey, but the real growth comes in the middle, or, you know, a third in or near the end, where you realize this isn't even my goal, or I wanted this a long time ago. I don't want this anymore. I want to create something else. Or I'm not even a goal person. I've had that before. So I'm not even into goals. I just thought that's what I had to be. That was a thing, you know. So then I might ask, so how do you want to navigate your life? And I had one client say, I want the compass of my life to be about how I feel in certain situations.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting about that is coming full circle to what you talked about before, this lockdown could actually get a lot of people reflecting now on, oh, crap, that's not even the goal I want, because actually we're not traveling, we're not here, there and everywhere. So I think that's interesting point at this point in time.
Yeah, this time could be very revealing for people. And there have been a few great memes about this, where it's kind of said, oh, I thought I wasn't doing the thing because I didn't have the time. And now I've realized that time was not the issue. And time is rarely the issue. When we're committed, we will let go of other things to create the time for the thing that's important. But I also think we need to be mindful as well. There's a lot of pressure out there to produce. You know, now's the time to produce. Now's the time to make, to build, to create. And it may be I have some incredibly productive, creative days and then not so much. And you know, radical self-care does not look like giving yourself pressure and judging yourself or others for what they are or are not doing. We don't have to produce anything in this time. Like I said earlier, you could just sleep. That will set you in good stead for when the new normal, you know, appears, whatever that looks like.
Sleep? What's that?
My goal is to sleep.
No, and it is interesting. This morning was quite funny, actually. I've got a really quite busy day to day, which is sort of a little bit unusual for me at this point in time where I'm sort of more bubs focused. And actually this morning I allowed myself to sleep in because I was like, I'm going to have a full on day. And right now the best thing I think I can do for myself is actually sleep. But that's quite a rare occasion in my world.
I also had a sleep in this morning. Yeah.
Oh, nice. So I want to pick up on the point you made before, which I loved, when you were talking about we might think about some of the obstacles that might come up and how we'll navigate them. And you said it's not always as smooth plain sailing as that. So I want to talk about setbacks and how sort of what guidance you would give for people to get back on the horse and navigate setbacks, because it could be that coronavirus is your setback. It could be, you know, other things. You're an endurance athlete, you know, you get injured, you just lost a big client, whatever it is that, you know, is the setback for you. What's your guidance around how we navigate those setbacks and when it's not smooth sailing as we thought it was going to be?
I would say do not get back on the horse until you have attended to your feelings. Otherwise, you will be off that horse before the horse has even started trotting. When we have setbacks, there is grief and there is sadness and there is disappointment and there is upset. And you may need to go to bed for an hour, a day, a couple of days, a week. You may need to not look at the goal. You may need not to not have communication with people that are part of the goal or the team and communicate that. I'm not saying go AWOL. But so many people want to just get back on the horse, get back on the horse, come on, just get back on the horse. And I know that that really serves certain people in certain events and certain moments of time, but it's not always the best way to go. Sometimes it's staying on the ground for a little bit, watching the horse go off and fixing your wounds and having a drink of water and taking a thought about, why did I fall off of the horse? What did I do beforehand? Did I see this coming? Did I hope that I would fall off of the horse? You know, we are very complex. We're tricky, you know. We can create little sabotages for ourselves that have us not carry out what we want to carry out. So I would say spend some time on the ground, in the mud, licking your wounds, having a little think and reflective. Do I want to get back on the horse? And then, you know, horses will just walk down a little bit. They generally don't just gallop off to nowhere. And get back on the horse when you're ready, because you'll have more strength, you'll have more clarity, and then you can keep going. Attend to your feelings.
And do you, because I think a lot of people process and attend to their feelings on that point in different ways. Some people are real journalers, some people are real talkers. Yeah. So do you also sort of give people guidance there around, you know, lean into whatever it is for you, because there's not necessarily a one size fits all in that sort of space? Because some people are like, journal.
Yeah. So it's so funny, isn't it? You must meditate. You must journal. You must do this. You must move your body. And it's like some people are just like, no, I don't want to. Absolutely. As a coach, my role, one of my roles is to ask questions, not to tell. So I don't say you should do this. I will say, what do you find is the best way for you to process your feelings? And one client will say, I need to talk to my best friend. One will say, talk to my mum. One will say, I journal. One will say, actually, I'd like to go for long walks. One will say, I like to dance it out. Whatever it is, there's no right way. There's just the way that works. So that would be what I occasionally do as a coach, is I would say, can I make a suggestion? If I've known the client for a very long time, then I can say, you know, can I make a suggestion? And my suggestion may be, I remember that you said a couple of sessions ago that A, B, C, and D, have you thought about that as an option for now? You know, so it's just kind of reminding them of what they already know.
Do you know what I found really powerful? And this sounds almost silly, but I did a diploma in positive psychology a few years ago, and they encouraged us to use this app called Mood Meter. Mm-hmm. And for a 2-week period, several times during the day, you had to record what your mood was and then an explanation of what you were doing. So for me at that time, it would be something like, oh, I'm feeling really like invigorated, or I'm feeling really, you know, energized or whatever, because I just went for a run or whatever it might be. And then if you were feeling in a mood that might be like, actually, I'm feeling down, I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling, you know, whatever that mood might be, it'll say, do you want to shift your state? So do you want to shift it? And if you do want to shift it, here's some things that have been in, you know, the happy, uplifted state. And it gives you a list of suggestions. Now, for me, what's really interesting about that is I know that I feel good after going for a run, or I know that I feel good after chatting to a mate. But sometimes what I found useful about it is it was that inspiration list in front of me to go, oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because sometimes we don't remember, you know, so when we're in it, we forget the things that make us feel better. So there are so many ways. I mean, there's also a movement around, you know, just kind of doing like things that make me happy page. I'm a creative journaler as well as a writing journaler. And, you know, there are these beautiful pages where it says things that make me happy. And it's things like making a cup of tea or, you know, eating the favorite chocolate or calling the particular friend or looking at the particular magazine and we forget. So it is that can be a really powerful tool for some people to literally have a list of things that lift my mood. Because when we're in the mood, we don't always remember what it is that lifts us out.
And that's something I've really enjoyed on that note about your Instagram at the moment, where you're doing the delight diaries. Mm. So many of the things that people are picking out that was a delight in their day are just the little things that are just, you know, particularly with nature, I think there's been a common theme.
Yes, nature and connection with other people was the common theme. So, yeah, you're right. You know, this the virus hit and I was out running one day and I thought, oh, how can I contribute in the, you know, in the online space without pretending I'm now an expert in this area, without telling people what they should be doing, without putting any pressure. I think as a coach, people can think it's all about productivity and go, 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 go. And I thought about this idea of the Delight Diaries last year, but hadn't really known what I was going to do with it. It just came to my head. And then as I was on this run, I saw this sunflower and it was about 7 a.m. in the morning and the sun was shining on the sunflower and it literally took my breath away. And I thought, this is it. This is the light. Maybe I can create a little platform where we can share our delights through this time. And I posted the sunflower and I share this is what it is. And so once or twice a week now, yeah, I just post, this is my delight of the day, what is yours? And you're right, it's nature. I saw, you know, a bird eating, you know, an insect. Or I saw yesterday, actually, I saw a bird. I was sitting on my deck and we have a see-through ceiling on the deck and a bird arrived with, actually, it was quite sad, a praying mantis, you know, a bright green praying mantis. But I suddenly felt like I was in my own David Attenborough documentary. Like here it was, the wild above my head in Brunswick in Melbourne. And then the bird flew off and it literally felt like, wow, like I just got to see that moment in nature, such as a brief moment. Another thing was baking. There's a lot of baking going on. People are finding a lot of delight in dancing and also a lot of connection with children, you know, how children delight in the smallest things. And I had a moment the other day where it was two toddlers, so maybe a four-year-old and a two-year-old. They were siblings and they were chasing two butterflies. And the two-year-old's delight, like, was literally completely beside himself, spinning in circles, trying to get this butterfly. And watching his delight gave me delight for the day. So, yes, we've lost a lot of our freedoms. People may perceive that we've lost a lot of freedoms. And yet we can still experience these real, pure, real moments of delight.
Yeah, I love it. It's been actually really fun to watch because you sort of share some of people's delights as well. And it's kind of quite good sort of inspiration as well. So on that note, I actually want to talk about some of your sort of go-to, I'd call it, you know, my words, high performance habits and things that have been sort of quite game-changing for you, because you talked about being a yoga instructor. We've talked about you doing endurance. We've talked about you having meditation practice. We talked about the delights and sort of appreciating some of nature. We've talked about, you know, crumpets and baking. So there's sort of quite a few sort of go-to, I'd say sort of high performance and self-care habits that you have. What are sort of the two or three for you that have been just absolutely, they've been the game changers and sort of more instrumental that you would sort of lean into more than others?
It's interesting. I mean, in some ways it kind of sounds quite trite and cliche and boring, so I can't give you two. And I have mentioned the main ones, which are definitely yoga. I mean, it's interesting. I trained as a yoga teacher and I taught yoga for 5 years in England, but then realized I needed yoga as a foundation for me to live my life. I realized that I couldn't teach it. I'm so glad for yoga teachers that can, but I realized that I didn't want to use my yoga as a business. I wanted to use it for my, you know, own self. So yoga is important to me. Meditation is important to me and journaling is important to me. So that's cliche. Lots of people say that and that's fine. I think the things that I would add that maybe are a little bit different is that I take Fridays off. If I'm speaking, it depends, you know, with a speaking engagement, sometimes they fall on a Friday, but if I'm home, I have Friday to do whatever I want. I used to try and pre-planned Fridays with things that felt good at the time. And then I'd get to the Friday and just go, I don't want to do that thing. So now I wake up on a Friday and I decide what I'm going to do. Sometimes that's writing, sometimes that's gardening, sometimes it's calling a friend, sometimes it's meeting a friend for lunch. It's whatever I want to do on that day. So that's number one. The second one is I have a lot of fun.
I can believe that.
Yeah. Fun is really important to me. I find it anywhere in crazy, stupid little ways. Fun is invigorating. Fun brings me joy. It brings me delight. I've even created workshops in the past that have been purely around the childhood games that we used to play. So, you know, like piggyback races and egg and spoon race and three-legged races. And I've done that with, you know, 200 fully grown women to the point that people were literally wetting their knickers from absolute joy of not being able to, you know, their legs are tied together and they just cannot move and they've fallen all over each other. And so for me, fun is part of high performance because you need to have an outlet. And I think Arianna Huffington has talked about this so well in the last few years, that to have this idea that thriving is about go, 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 go is a disservice to what you're capable of, that we need to create and we need to play and we need to rest and we need to sleep and we need to connect. And all of those things contribute to us being a whole human being. And as a whole human being, that's when we're going to fulfill our potential, not by taking one aspect, which is very, you know, yang, and just, you know, I have to just go, keep moving all the time. We know the only road that leads to is burnout. And we don't have to get to burnout before we realize that we are more than our doing and that focusing on our being is as important, if not more important than what we do.
And it's interesting because fun is so much part of, like, when I did my diploma in positive psychology, like, you learn how much actually fun and humor is so much part of well-being. When the coronavirus first hit, my brother actually happened to be staying with us, and my brother and I resort to being children when we're together. And so we started doing skipping competitions with each other. We started doing cartwheel competitions with each other. And we were honestly pissing ourselves laughing, trying to like do a bloody cartwheel. I think I pulled every muscle going in my legs. But we just started having a bit of fun, and actually it really helped both of us at that point in time when the coronavirus stuff was just going down. And yeah, fun, I think it can be a really great strategy and an underrated strategy to lean into.
Yes, and I think that is what people are leaning to. And as I said earlier, this idea that, you know, this is the time for the artists, you know, the people that can use words, that can use humour, that can draw. You know, I'm so drawn. There's some incredibly funny people out there, and I feel that the world is giving them space now to bring their gifts, because we need those gifts. We need the gifts of the artist. We need the beauty of words and the humor of words to get us through. Like, I can't imagine how much Monty Python has been downloaded right now.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, you know, slapstick, just comedy, just some pure good old comedy is what we all need, because the world is quite serious, and which is understandable, but it doesn't mean that we can't have some fun and some delight at the same time.
Well said. Nicely said. So with that, I want to just do two quick fire questions before I let you run away from us and go put your Dare to Lead hoodie on and, you know, do all that sort of stuff. Number one, what book has had the biggest impact on you other than your own?
This is so funny because I'm going to be a bad guess. I'm not going to give you one book. I have to give you a few books, but I will say them very, very quickly. Okay, so when it comes to leadership and the work that I do, I would definitely say that the Dare to Lead book was life-changing, hence why I landed in Texas. And I'd also say it's a very old book now, but it's called The Success Principles by a guy called Jack Canfield. He started the Chicken Soup for the Soul book. It's a very old book, but it's old school, and I like that old school business. You know, that building a sustainable business takes time, and being a kind person helps. In terms of novels, the books that have changed my life are East of Eden by John Steinbeck and The Color Purple by Alice Walker. And in terms of creative books, I would say all the books by Stephen Pressfield, and I would also say Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert.
I reread that. I was so upset that I missed you interviewing Liz Gilbert when she was in Sydney recently, and so I had to go reread the book to sort of pretend that I'd been there.
Yeah, that was incredible hanging out with Liz for all that time. It was great.
I saw her on Instagram, wasn't jealous at all. And my final one I've got to ask on that note is you have interviewed so many incredible people. I was going to be really nasty and ask you to pick your favorite, but then I was like, I can't ask her that. So instead, I was like, oh, I'm going to ask who haven't you interviewed or met who you would absolutely love to? Because you've interviewed in the past year Marie Forleo, Liz Gilbert, you know, some absolutely incredible people.
Oh, there's only one person. It's Oprah.
Oh.
It's Oprah. Yeah. That would be the icing on the cake. If that happens, then I will then just kind of go to bed and eat crumpets forever.
You have full permission to just eat crumpets and that's it. Your work here is done. You can go to your deathbed knowing you've done your good work.
Exactly, exactly. And also I think if there was one other person, it's more kind of homegrown actually, it is Richard Feidler. So Richard Feidler does conversations for ABC Radio. He is such an incredible interviewer. It would be amazing to interview him.
Oh, I've not come across him. I need to go check him out now.
Conversations, ABC. It's great. It's a great podcast.
Amazing. Thank you so, so much. You've been so generous and so open, and I have just absolutely loved this conversation and got so much out of it. If people want to go and follow your Delight Diaries or more about you, where are people best to go and check you out and hang out with you?
Okay, so in terms of the Delight Diaries, then I'm my name, so Kemi Netkapil, at Kemi Netkapil on Instagram. Everything I'm doing is there. In terms of organisations or individuals, in terms of leadership coaching, please go to my website, which is keminetkapil.com. And as Abby has already mentioned, I do have a podcast called The Shift Series, and that is wherever you get your podcasts. Very short little coaching prods. I believe in self-coaching. Sometimes we don't give ourselves the space to ask ourselves the right questions, to give ourselves the answers that we need, and we now have the time. So that may be something that's helpful and a resource for people at this time.
And what I like about the podcast, like I mentioned earlier, is because they're actually quite short, I think they're working quite well for me at the moment, because you don't have, like, I'm not necessarily having the 1 hour commute. You might need that slither of a 15 minute. So they're quite handy at this point in time.
Yeah, you can listen while you're doing the dishes.
Yep. Amazing. Thank you so much. I've really, really loved having you on. So thank you for your time, Kemi. Thanks for joining us.
My absolute pleasure, Abby. You do such wonderful work in the world. It's a pleasure to be here today.
If you enjoyed this episode with Kemi, Kemi is actually going to be speaking at a virtual Business Chicks event called All Stars Homegrown on the 30th of April. If you want to find out more about that event, go to Business Chicks website, so just businesschicks.com, and you can see the full details there for the event. If you can't make it on the 30th, still check it out, because Business Chicks are going to be sharing the recordings with you afterwards, so you can still take the opportunity to hear Kemi in action. And I promise you, speaking from personal experience, it is game-changing and life-changing and worth attending. So pop to businesschicks.com and check out all the details there.